I was always lost in a book, whether I was actually reading or imagining myself as a character. If bad things happened, like Birju developing pneumonia and having to wear an oxygen mask, I would think that soon I would be able to go back to my reading, and then time would vanish, and when I re-entered the world, the difficult thing would be gone or changed. I often lied about my reading. The books I liked were science fiction and fantasy, books where things were not as complicated and unsatisfying as real life. I claim to have read more famous books, though. The ones our teachers told us were for older students, or the ones that had been made into movies. One winter morning in 9th grade, while it was still dark outside, I sat at our kitchen table and began reading a biography of Ernest Hemingway called The Young Hemingway, hoping that if I read the biography, I could then more effectively pretend to have read him. All I knew about Hemingway was that he was famous and that he was a writer. The biography opens with Hemingway on a boat that is entering New York Harbor. The day is gray and seagulls are soaring above him. He is returning to America from Paris and World War I. As I read about Hemingway having been to Spain and France, I was amazed. I couldn't believe that an actual person had gotten to go to Spain and France. What was even more amazing was that this man had done it without being a doctor or an engineer. Till then, I had thought that the only way to have a good life was to have one of these two professions. As I sat there reading, I got happier and happier. To have a life where one traveled, where one did what one wanted, seemed like being rich. The light outside the window turned blue. Trees and nearby houses grew visible, as if they were emerging out of water. The happiness was so intense, it was as if my chest were being stretched. It took several days to finish the biography. I read it mostly at the kitchen table. As I read, I began wanting to be a writer. I had written short stories in class before. Now, I thought about how wonderful it would be to be a writer and get attention and get to travel and not have to be a doctor or an engineer. As I sat there reading, my mother came in and out of the kitchen. She opened and closed the refrigerator. She prepared meals. Fantasizing about a life which was far away from her and Birju, I felt like I was doing something dishonest. The same day that I finished the biography, I went to the library. I asked the librarian if there were more books on Hemingway. The woman, young, pregnant, asked if I wanted books about Hemingway or by him. I felt embarrassed saying that I did not want to read his works, that I only wanted to learn how to be a writer and get famous.
"About him," I murmured.
She smiled and appeared pleased. I think she mistook my interest as me being scholarly. She led me to an aisle and showed me the library's 10 or 12 hardbacks on Hemingway. The biographer had mentioned that Hemingway's style was very simple. I understood this to mean that if I became a writer, I wouldn't have to be very good, that being merely acceptable would be sufficient for me to have a good life. I checked out all the books. In my bedroom, I sat on the floor behind my bed so that if anybody came in, I would not be immediately seen and so, in this way, I felt hidden. I began reading the books with a mixture of hope and embarrassment. I started with the thinnest book. It was a collection of essays. I began by reading the book's introduction. Normally, when I did things that appeared difficult, like connecting a VCR with a TV, I didn't read the instructions, for I was afraid of failure, and reading the directions only made me more anxious that I would fail. With learning to write, I wanted to do everything that could possibly help. Usually it embarrassed me to read slowly, as if the amount of time I was spending proved I was stupid. This time I read each paragraph carefully. If my mind wandered in the middle, I reread the paragraph, which happened several times a page. The first essay compared physical space in Hemingway's only play, The Fifth Column, with physical space in the story, Hills Like White Elephants. I didn't know the play or the story. I didn't understand the terms that the essay used. The sentences were like long weeds waving from the bottom of a muddy pond. I read the essay carefully, afraid, trying to hold what I could in my head. The second essay made no sense either. As I read it, I felt stupid for having thought I could be a writer. Still, I kept reading. Now and then I learned something that struck me as practical. One essay said that Hemingway got away with writing plainly because he wrote about exotic things. If he were to write about ordinary things in an ordinary way, he would be boring. This remark was inserted in the middle of a paragraph. Reading it, I was shocked that something so important could be hidden like this. As long as I wrote about exotic things, I thought, I could then be a not very good writer and still be successful. Another essay said that all of Hemingway's protagonists are noble. If they were not, the lack of emotion in the prose would make them seem to be psychopaths. I thought that if I were to write, this was a clue as to what kind of characters I should write about. From an essay on ecology, I learned that Hemingway often used repetition to create a physical impression, that in Big Two-Hearted River, he described the weather as hot, and then a little later, he described the back of the character's neck as hot. In that same essay, the author mentioned that physical description in Hemingway's third-person narratives tends to be at the start of paragraphs, while in first-person narratives, physical description gets spread throughout the paragraph. Still another essay referred to how the dialogue tags he said and she said usually come at the end of a line of speech. Sometimes, though, when characters are very emotional, speech is preceded with Henry said or Kathy said, and putting the label before the dialogue makes it feel stilted. This acts as a way of tamping down emotion and forces the reader to invest in trying to feel what the characters feel. Each of these things I noticed and put away. I wondered what it would be like to actually read Hemingway. Would I find it boring? The second book I read was a slightly thicker collection of essays. Once again, I rarely understood what the writers were talking about. But now, I knew a few more things. An essayist wrote that The Old Man and the Sea is full of factual inaccuracies, that it is impossible to carry miles of fishing line on one's shoulder. Even though I hadn't read the novel, I felt I knew the book from having read other essays. I read about Hemingway's mistakes and felt that what probably matters in a book is its emotional truth, and not whether small facts are accurate. Still another essayist mentioned how Hemingway, when he wanted to make his dialogue surprising, would take speech he had assigned to one character and give it to another, that some of the dialogue spoken by the Jewish character in The Sun Also Rises originally belonged to the protagonist of the novel. Giving the Jewish character this dialogue made him less one-dimensional. Reading these books, I had the feeling that I was being transformed. I felt like I was being connected to a world where stories were written and where they were studied. Feeling myself being connected, I had the sense that I was being taken away from my own life and brought into a world that was glamorous, where people did pleasurable things, where people did not worry all the time. It took me several months to read the critical books. When I was done with them, I asked my mother to take me to the mall. The B. Dalton bookseller was on the second floor. Mostly it sold magazines, calendars, greeting cards. In the front of the store was a wall of magazines, and there were tables that offered books by the foot. Beyond this, after shelves devoted to psychology and spirituality, was a section called literature. I went to this and looked for Hemingway. There was a shelf and a half of paperbacks. My mother stood beside me as I pulled out different titles. Her watching me made me nervous. Because she often looked to criticize me, I felt she might think I was wasting money. The books were white with black drawings of matadors and of hills and small boats. I had decided to buy them instead of checking them out of the library because I felt that spending money would force me to read them. At the cash register, My mother watched as I paid with money I had received for various birthdays. I could feel her gaze. That night, during dinner, my mother told my father that I had used my own money to buy books.
"What an amazing boy," she said. "It's very good what you are doing, Ajay."
She said this seriously. I sat hidden on the floor behind my bed and began reading. I started with the first book that he had published. The stories bored me. When I read the one about the mules having their knees broken and being thrown off a pier in a besieged city, I felt nothing. I understood from what I had read that the plainness of the writing was supposed to let the reader form his own response. To me, though, the mules didn't feel real, and neither did the pier. Till then, I had only read about Hemingway, never anything by him. I had been afraid to do so because what would happen if I didn't like him? Reading the stories, I became afraid that I might have wasted all the time that I had spent with the critical essays. Surely my not liking the stories showed some failure in me. I began to take notes as I read. Doing something while reading reduced my anxiety at not being interested. I started counting the number of words in each sentence. On top of each sentence, I wrote a 3 or 5 or 7 in blue ink. Because I knew "and" was an important word in Hemingway's sentences, I circled each "and." Every page I read became crowded with blue writing. I started "The Sun Also Rises." When there were stretches of dialogue and the page looked bare, I circled the "he said," "she said," or wrote "no dialogue" label. I got to the end of the first chapter and began reading it again. A quarter of the way into the book, I started to respond in the ways that I thought Hemingway had wanted his readers to react. At one point in the novel, a burly wealthy man lifts up his shirt to show scars from arrow wounds. I had read an essay about this character. Because the essay had told me what I should feel, I felt it. A sense of the two main characters of the novel being shoved to the side of the story by a character whose world is so much larger than theirs. The change in perspective was a physical sensation, like standing up suddenly and becoming lightheaded at the room pulling away. As I kept reading Hemingway, who seemed to so value suffering in silence, I began to see my family's pain as belonging in a story. In the morning, watching my father bathe Birju, I fantasized about writing how my father's pajamas grew wet and translucent until I could see through to his underwear. At the idea of writing sentences that contained our suffering, I experienced both the triumph that I had felt when I told Jeff and Michael Boo about Birju, and also a sort of detachment, like I was watching my own life. Other things in my life, though, were too undignified and strange to be converted into literature. A housing development was being built a few blocks away, with frames of yellow 2x4s and lawns of orange dirt. A few houses were nearly complete. These had "for sale" signs before them, and their lawns were newly covered in rectangles of sod. Often, either because my father did not believe that grass could be considered property, or because he did not wish to believe this, he drove to the houses and stole their grass. He tore the sod off the ground and put it into the back of our silver station wagon and brought it home. As he placed these pads all over our lawn, my mother came out and shouted at him that at least he should be smart and do this at night. After 4 or 5 months of reading Hemingway, I decided to write a story. I had in the past written stories for English classes. These had all been about white people, because white people's stories seemed to matter more. Also, I hadn't known how to write about Indians. How would I translate the various family relations, the difference between an uncle who is a father's brother and an uncle who is a mother's brother? Having read Hemingway, I knew that I should just push all the exotic things to the side as if they didn't matter, that this was how one used exoticism, by not bothering to explain. The first story I wrote was about my brother coughing. I woke one night to the sound of Birju coughing downstairs, and then could not go back to sleep. To be woken this way and not be able to return to sleep struck me as sad enough to merit a reader's attention. Also, Hemingway had written a story about a man being woken because somebody is dying nearby, and the man is forced to witness the death. I got up from my bed and turned on the light. I then returned to bed with a spiral-bound notebook and placed it against my knees. I began my story in the middle of the action, the way Hemingway did. I wrote,
"The coughing wakes me. My wife coughs and coughs, and then when her throat is clear, she moans. The nurse's aide moves back and forth downstairs. The hospital bed jingles."
I wrote that it was a spouse coughing because that seemed something a reader could identify with, while a brother would be too specific to me.
"I lie here, listening to my wife cough, and it is hard to believe that she is dying." It was strange to write something down and for that thing to come into existence. The fact that the sentence existed made Birju's coughing somehow less awful. As I sat on my bed, I thought about how I could end my story. I held my pencil above the sheet of paper. According to the essays I had read on Hemingway, all I needed to do was attach something to the end of the story that was both unexpected and natural. I imagined Birju dying. This had to be what would eventually happen. As soon as I imagined this, I did not want him gone. I felt a surge of love for Birju. Even though he was sick and swollen, I did not want him gone. I wrote, "I lie in my bed and listen to her cough, and am glad she is coughing because this means she is alive. Soon she will die, and I will no longer be among the lucky people whose wives are sick. Fortunate are the men whose wives cough. Fortunate are the men who cannot sleep through the night because their wives' coughing wakes them."
Writing the story changed me. Now I began to feel as if I were walking through my life collecting things that could be used later. The sound of a ping-pong ball was like a woman walking in high heels. The shower running was like television static. Seeing things as material for writing protected me. When a boy tried to start a fight by saying, "You're vegetarian. Does that mean you don't eat pussy?" I thought this would be something I could use in a story. At the end of ninth grade, as I was about to turn 15, I and 10 other students had straight A's. This meant that we were all ranked first in our class. The day school ended, there was a carnival atmosphere. Students emptied their lockers into the hallways, throwing papers, magazine cutouts, and greeting cards all over the floors. In each classroom, a sheet of paper was pinned to the bulletin board, and typed on this were the names of those ranked first in their grade. Seeing my name in type made it feel like another person's. When I came home, my mother was exercising Birju, moving his arms up and down as if he were marching. "Mami," I said, my hand on Birju's foot, because by showing respect I could make myself younger.
"I'm ranked first in my class." "Very good," my mother answered, continuing to pump Birju's arms.
She didn't say any more. I had been feeling proud as well as guilty, and now I felt a collapse. And then I became disgusted with myself for my vanity in wanting to be thought special when 10 other children were also ranked first. People phoned and asked my mother if I could speak to their children. I remembered how the same thing had happened when Birju got into the Bronx High School of Science. I remembered my jealousy then. Now, talking on the phone to those children, it seemed to me that to be one among 11 students was nothing compared to Birju getting into his school after only a year and a half in America. My mother and I began to be invited to people's houses so that their children could see me and realize that boys who were ranked first looked and sounded like anybody else. One night, I sat between two girls, 6 and 10, at a dining room table. My mother and the girls' parents, both doctors, sat across from me. I spoke and spoke. I remembered how my father had talked when we sat in Mr. Gupta's Mercedes.
For Indians, it is important to do well in English. There are so many of us who do well in math that colleges don't pay math and science much attention.
The mother of the girls asked,
These teachers, they don't favor their own?
She said this in Hindi, as if this fear of favoritism, which was a reasonable one in India, prompted her to speak like she was still there. Her husband asked whether I played Atari and whether I thought it was worth buying a computer.
A typewriter is all one needs, I said.
Like his wife, the man also spoke timidly. I found it strange that two doctors could have fears. A few of the men we visited appeared to see me as competition. One man twisted my earlobe and said,
So, genius, you are very smart.
Another man had me sit on a white sofa while he sat on a white easy chair at a right angle from me. Then he tested me on how much I knew. He asked what words percent was a contraction of and how many elements were on the periodic table. I felt important because of my class rank. Soon after 10th grade started, I tried getting a girlfriend. Rita was 5'3". She had thick eyebrows, a heart-shaped face, and wavy hair that fell to her shoulders. She spoke without an accent. This and the fact that she sat with white girls at lunch placed her in a better world than mine. One afternoon, I phoned her from my parents' room. I paced by my parents' bed, the phone to my ear. My mother had just prayed, and there was an incense stick smoking on the altar. The phone began to ring on the other end.
Hello?
A girl said.
Is Rita there?
I asked. I stood looking out a window. Outside, the trees were changing color.
Yes, hold on. Who's this?
Ajay.
Ajay from Morristown?
From school.
Rita!
The girl screamed. A moment later, there was an echo as an extension was lifted.
Who's this?
Another girl said. I thought this was Rita, but wasn't sure.
Rita? Yes?
It's Ajay.
Ajay from Morristown?
No, from school.
Ajay?
We're in math class together.
Okay.
There was silence. I had decided to tell Rita I loved her. This was because from having watched Hindi movies, it seemed that if one was to have a relationship with a girl, one had to be in love. Also, it seemed easier to say I loved her than to have a conversation.
I think you're very beautiful, I said.
Rita didn't reply. I became silent again. I stared out the picture window above my parents' bed. Our backyard ran into another, and this second yard into a third, and the leaves of the trees were gold and orange.
You are the most beautiful girl in school.
My face and neck were burning.
Thank you.
Would you like to go on a date?
Rita was silent for a moment.
With you?
Yes.
No.
I began to make excuses for having called.
I only asked because I thought you didn't have a boyfriend.
Suddenly Rita shrieked,
Are you on the phone?
Yes,
I murmured.
Get off, get off!
I heard the huh, huh, huh of somebody laughing.
Get off!
I wanted to hang up.
I love you.
I felt somehow obligated to say this.
Went
the other person on the line.
I'll call you back,
Rita said.
Do you need my phone number?
She hung up. For a few days, I was embarrassed. The first time I entered math class after the call, I saw Rita, and my entire back became hot. I knew enough about myself to realize that I had to immediately try again with another girl. If I didn't, I would seize up with shyness. With this second girl, I tried not to be too ambitious. Meenakshi was not pretty. She was shorter than Rita and had a worried, pinched face. When she walked down the school's hallways, she kept both straps of her book bag over her shoulders, and she hunched forward as if carrying a heavy burden. Meenakshi's father owned a television repair shop and said that he was an engineer, though my father said that it was obvious that he had not even finished high school. Right after we brought Birju from the nursing home, Mr. Nair had suggested we transport Birju to his house and try dipping him into his swimming pool. Mr. Nair was very conservative. My mother had once volunteered my father to drive Meenakshi and her sisters somewhere, and Mrs. Nair had said her husband did not like men who were not relatives to be alone with their daughters. One afternoon, Meenakshi was walking down a set of the school's stairs. She was holding a binder across her chest, and she looked pained, as she often did. I was climbing the stairs. There were boys and girls around us, and their footsteps and voices made the stairwell loud. Passing her, I said, "I love you." I said this in an ordinary conversational voice. Meenakshi continued down the stairs. She seemed not to have heard. A few days later, she was kneeling by her locker, a forest of jean-clad legs around her. I went up to her and, walking swiftly, dropped a scrap of paper in her hair. She grabbed the top of her head, looking angry, like someone used to being treated badly. I remembered being spat on while crouched before my locker. The note said, "I love you." For a while, I continued trying to hide myself when I told Meenakshi I loved her. We were in the same gym class. Running past her in her big baggy shorts, banging a basketball against the floor, I whispered, "I love you." Sometimes she appeared to have heard me. She would look around open-mouthed. Telling Meenakshi I loved her, slipping notes through the grill of her locker door, was like taking part in an adventure. I also, though, regularly blamed Meenakshi for the nervousness I was experiencing from telling her I loved her. About a week after I started doing this, I was walking down a hallway, and she was walking toward me. The hallway was crowded and noisy. There were voices and locker doors slamming and rattling. I was thinking about whether it was possible to drift across the hall toward Meenakshi, whisper my love, and disappear without being noticed. Meenakshi saw me and stopped. I came near her. We were 2 or 3 feet apart. She was wearing a shiny pink blouse.
"Ajay?"
she said. I stopped. She crossed over toward me. She looked hurt.
"Are you the one telling me you love me?"
I worried she might tell her parents, who would then inform my mother. I was afraid, though, of passing up the opportunity of getting a girlfriend. "Yes."
"Okay. We can talk after school."
She walked away. Immediately, I felt regret. To me, all relationships were serious and full of obligations, and the idea of having one suddenly felt like a burden. At the end of the day, Meenakshi and I met outside our school's doors. Yellow buses lined the horseshoe driveway. We walked up toward the road. At first, we didn't talk. My mouth was dry. When we reached the road, we turned right, in the direction of where she lived. The sidewalk went up a slope. Both of us were bent under our book bags. A part of me was still afraid that Meenakshi was going to threaten to tell her mother. I had known boys who had approached girls, and the girls had done so. Meenakshi, not looking at me, said,
"My father won't let me receive phone calls."
This seemed to imply that she was open to being my girlfriend. I was relieved.
"My parents don't like me getting calls either, except from boys."
"I don't want anyone to know I have a boyfriend. Somebody might tell my mother just to cause trouble."
"Me too. People gossip."
"Studies come first."
I nodded quickly.
"For me also. Marriage and love can come when studies are done and one is established in one's profession."
"We can talk,"
Meenakshi said,
But only if we are alone and nobody can overhear.
I don't want sex until I'm married.
I don't want a kiss.
Raising the standards of what was proper was a way of making myself more appealing, more trustworthy. We stopped talking. The air was cold and smelled of moist earth, and this seemed wonderful. We came to a street corner and crossed. On the other side, Meenakshi said,
If you had a dog, what would you name it?
In the past, when I had thought about having a dog, I had imagined that possessing one would make me white, like one of those boys on TV who hugged their pet when unhappy. I had given this dog an American-type name like Scout or Goldie. Now, imagining a dog within the context of having a girlfriend, it seemed disloyal to give the dog a white dog's name, as if then I would be giving affection to a white dog instead of an Indian one, and so would not be acting adult and proper.
Something Indian, I said.
Me too.
Meenakshi became silent. The road we were on began to curve away. After a moment, Meenakshi said,
I'll be your girlfriend.
Good, I said and stopped. I have to turn back.
Don't call me,
she said.
My parents will get upset.
Okay, I won't. You don't call either.
Within a few weeks, Meenakshi and I were kissing. When I tried to get us to start doing this, I wasn't sure how to suggest it without appearing like I was going back on my word. I therefore pouted and hinted vaguely at Birju being sick so Meenakshi would try comforting me. Behind our school was a football field bordered by a track. Beyond this were woods. The woods, mostly maples and crab apples, were where students who did not have places to make out went. Meenakshi and I walked into the woods one afternoon. The day was very cold, and the fallen leaves reached our ankles. When we had gone far enough for the school between the trees to look distant, we stopped. I was excited to kiss for the first time. I also felt that I was taking advantage of Meenakshi. To me, it seemed that the only reason she was coming into the woods with me was because she was trying to soothe me, that she felt no desire of her own. Meenakshi was wearing a long blue parka that came to her knees. I was wearing a blue ski jacket. We hugged. Our coats squeaked. My heart was racing. I brought my face down to hers. The warmth of her body, the smell of spices from what she ate, surprised me. She felt real and mysterious in a way that took me aback. I believed that proper kissing required not breathing on the person one was kissing. We kissed and kissed. I held my breath. Blue sparks floated before me. School ended at 2:35, and the nurse's aide left at 4. I had to get back before then. I walked home. The sky looked somehow new. I was so happy that my pace kept speeding up. I had the feeling that everything would be okay for me, that one day everything would be fine. Birju was lying on his exercise bed beneath the chandelier. Seeing him, I remembered our apartment in Queens, how the intercom would ring when his girlfriend was downstairs. I remembered Nancy's long black hair. I wondered what had happened to her. Meenakshi and I kissed every day. Once it was raining and I didn't think we could go out, and she said,
I have an umbrella.
When she said this, I thought I had misheard her. The fact that she, too, wanted to kiss was hard to believe. I had meant to be like Amitabh Bachchan with Meenakshi, silent, mysterious. I found, though, that I could not stop talking, that when we were in the woods and I would pull away from her to breathe, I would immediately start speaking, that I wanted to talk as much as I wanted to kiss. At first I said the sorts of things that would stir up pity or portray me as brave. I told her about how smart Birju had been. I told her how I bathed him in the morning and how often, after we put him back into his hospital bed, Birju, warm and relaxed, tended to piss on himself. After a little while, though, I began telling her things which were so awful that I had somehow managed not to acknowledge them. When Birju had gotten pneumonia, he had had a series of convulsions. These had caused more brain damage. Before the convulsions, if there was a loud noise, he would swing his head in the direction of the noise. Now, when there was a noise, he wouldn't react. He'd remain smacking his lips and looking lost in thought. Earlier, Birju had been able to sit mostly straight in his wheelchair. Now, when we sat him up, he began slumping. To keep him upright, we had to put his arms through a vest of sorts. The vest was missing a back, but had long straps on the sides. We used these to tie Birju to his wheelchair. I did not normally spend money on the vending machines in school. Spending money made me anxious. After I told Meenakshi about this additional brain damage, I went back into the building and bought an ice cream. I think telling her was like releasing some enormous stress, and the ice cream was like how one sits down after a shock. I found myself falling in love. Meenakshi seemed kind and wonderful. Her small body, how I could gather it up in my arms like a bouquet, seemed the most extraordinary thing in the world. Loving her, I was scared. There were certain things I didn't tell her because they were humiliating. My father's drinking, my mother's irrationality and meanness. I expected to be judged based on my family, and not telling her about my parents, I felt as if I were pretending to be better than I was. Sometimes, coming home from kissing Meenakshi, I would see Birju on his exercise bed and get upset. I couldn't understand why everything wasn't better. I wanted to hurt someone or something. The only thing I could find to hurt was my relationship with Meenakshi. Priya was taller than I was and very skinny and had a nose like a beak. We were in biology class together, and I had spoken to her only a few times. I knew, though, that her father was a doctor, and she was very smart. Also, she sat with Rita and the white girls. I began telling Priya I loved her. Passing her on the staircase, I whispered this. I slipped little strips of paper into her locker. On the strips, I wrote poems. I did this 4 or 5 times, and then Priya came up to me in biology class. I was standing in the back alongside the bulletin boards.
"Did you write this?"
she asked, holding out one of the strips. The class had not yet begun, but most of the students were already there. I was conscious of their presence. I thought of Meenakshi finding out. "No," I said. Priya laughed.
"I heard you told Rita you loved her."
I didn't say anything. Sometimes on weekends, my parents went to temple or a prayer ceremony and were away for the afternoon. Meenakshi came over then. First, she would stand in Birju's room and say hello to him. When she did this, she looked serious. Afterward, we went upstairs. We would lie on my bed, fully clothed. We would kiss and rub against each other. I couldn't believe I was getting to do something so wonderful. Meenakshi seemed the embodiment of a future. The possibility of escape made me more impatient with my mother instead of less. She and I were now bathing Birju most mornings. Nearly always we fought as we did this. One morning in Birju's room, perhaps inspired by how eunuchs in India show up at people's houses and demand money and begin taking off their clothes to show they will do anything unless they are paid, I started stripping. I had just finished bathing my brother, cleaning his ass with a bar of soap, and my mother had been telling me that she knew I hated him, that whatever I did for him, I did because of guilt and not because of love. "Why should I have any shame?" I shouted once I was naked. My mother was near the foot of the bed, embracing a folded towel. She looked at me, stunned. This pleased me. We often sought to show that there was no limit to what we would say or do. After a moment, My mother wagged her head from side to side.
If Birju were all right, I would tell you to get out. I'd tell you to leave right now. Go with your stupid grades and die.
I was not going to let her have the last word.
How can they be so stupid when they're so high?
While my father's drinking was getting so bad that he hardly helped and my mother and I were fighting every day, my family was also becoming more and more famous. This was not only because my good grades had brought another level of attention to us, but also because the community was growing, and so there were simply more people to give attention. A large apartment complex, a row of brown brick buildings called Hilltop Apartments, had opened along a wide, busy road about a mile away. Almost all of the people who lived in Hilltop were Indians, new arrivals. Riding on the school bus, I often saw them walking along the sides of roads because they didn't have cars. At Temple, the women from Hilltop, women who worked at Kmart and grocery stores, carried see-through plastic purses. These people began visiting us. Many of them spoke neither Hindi nor English. When they came, they brought coconuts and bananas as if they were visiting an actual temple. Usually, they said nothing, or only the few words of Hindi that they knew. Namaste, beta, kush. Some of the women came into Birju's room, gripped his feet with both hands, and bowed and touched their foreheads to his feet. My father was now drinking all night long. Many nights, I woke at 3 or 4 in the morning from hearing him coming down the hallway. The upstairs bathroom was next to my room. My father kept a bottle of scotch beneath the bathroom sink. If the creaking of the hallway floor didn't wake me, the buzz of the fluorescent tube light turning on did. The wood of the bathroom door was swollen. One night, I heard the door being pulled close. I lay in bed and, unable to go back to sleep, became enraged. I left my room and came out into the dark hallway. A line of white light shone beneath the bathroom door. I wanted to shout at my father. I knocked.
"Who?" my father said in a slurred voice.
"Can I come in?"
I pushed the door. My father was standing by the window. He was wearing gray pajamas. His face was sagging, and his eyes were dilated. The window was open, and a moist spring breeze was blowing in. There was something about the reality of seeing my father's loose face that made me stop being angry.
"How are you, Daddy?"
I asked.
"I am so happy," he answered.
He was smiling. Another morning I woke to the sound of my mother's voice shouting with what sounded like alarm, and I hurried to my parents' room.
"You are going to lose your job,"
my mother cried. She was standing at the foot of the bed while my father lay before her.
"They're all like me, Shubha," he slurred. "It's a government office."
"We won't have insurance. Birju will be thrown out on the street."
"I'm union. They say, come to a meeting. I answer. Is there food? I only go to meetings with food."
My father was always late for work. Sometimes he left the house at noon. Sometimes he missed a day. Coming home from school, I would see his station wagon in the driveway, and my chest would tighten. I would walk into Birju's room, see my mother sitting by the exercise bed, reading to Birju, and her face would be grim. I would keep to myself then, because I didn't want her shouting at me. I'd go upstairs to my room and sit at my desk and read Hemingway. Hemingway had been an alcoholic, and his characters often drank too much. Their drinking appeared false, though, because there were no consequences. It was like how cartoon characters fall off cliffs without being injured. Spotting this lie in Hemingway made me feel superior to him, and this bit of superiority led me to feel anger and contempt, and being angry was pleasurable. At some point, my father began missing 1 or 2 days of work a week. he was put on probation. He told my mother that he sat in an office with his supervisor, his union representative, and a very fat man who was the human resources person. He signed a piece of paper to document that he had been notified of the complaint. When he had signed the paper, his supervisor said, "I don't care if you show up drunk. You just have to come to work."
"That's not what he means," the fat man murmured.
My father was not going to be told what to do.
"You want to show you have power,"
he shouted at his supervisor.
"I know you."
When she heard this, my mother said,
"They do have power."
"I am not going to be a slave, Shubha. Not for you, not for Birju."
"Always you find a way to bring in Birju."
A few days later, I came home from school, and my father was sitting at the kitchen table. He had his back to the window. He was trying to drink tea. His hands were shaking. My mother stood by the table.
"Your father is going to stop drinking."
I wondered if I was expected to pretend to believe this. We went to Birju's room. Birju had thick acne on his cheeks now as a side effect of one of his medications. The acne was as thick as bubbled paint, but because one was not expecting it, at first glance, he appeared to have rosy cheeks. My father put a hand on Birju's head. He swore on Birju's life that he would not drink. I saw this and thought I was watching some melodrama that my parents had concocted.
"We have to help him,"
my mother said to me. She said that my father was able to not drink on his own during the day. At night, though, the desire to drink was too much. He could not sleep without drinking. That night, after Birju had received his oral feeding, the three of us sat around his hospital bed playing cards until the nurse's aide came. When my father climbed the stairs, my mother and I followed. My mother carried a thermos of tea, and I held a tray before me. The tray was covered in plates of biscuits and sweets and bowls of nuts and various types of salty fried dough. In the bedroom, my mother flipped on the light switch by the door. She turned on the lamps that stood on the nightstands. The room became bright. There was a mirror on top of the dresser, and our reflection in this and the reflections in the windows made the room seem crowded. Pointing the remote control, she flicked on the TV. The noise added to the sense of busyness. We sat on my parents' bed and played cards with the plates spread around us. My father sat cross-legged, head bowed, looking hopeless. My mother asked me about school. "It will be harder to be ranked first this year than last," I said, angry that I was being asked to engage in this foolishness.
"Already making excuses."
"It will be harder. Each year it's harder."
The hours passed. Around 2 that night, my mother got tired. She turned to my father.
"Do you feel sleepy?"
"No."
She put a videotape in the VCR. I cleared the bed of plates and cups. We turned off the lights and lay stretched on the bed, my father in the middle. The television shook its light over us. My father didn't drink that night. The next evening, around 5, he called to say that he was leaving work and should be home by 6. The fact that my father made sure he told us this seemed to indicate that he was trying not to drink. This second night, too, I sat with my mother and father by Birju's bed. And then at 10, we marched up the stairs with the tea and snacks. 2 days passed without drinking, and then 3. I began feeling a strange exhilaration. At school, I would picture us going up the stairs with my father. I would look forward to this. For several months, my father did not drink. In my memory, this period is wonderful. 10th grade ended, and I was again ranked first. Summer started. I turned 16. During those months, I was so happy that at night I had a hard time sleeping. I would be asleep, yet I would be aware of my happiness the way that, when you sleep in a room full of sun, you are aware of the light. When he came home from work, my father was quiet, glum. Sometimes he would go upstairs to change his clothes and not come down. I would go get him, and he would be sitting at the edge of his bed looking overwhelmed. The only time my father was his old self was when he was fighting with my mother.
You don't care. You think you know what's right and that everybody else is a fool.
Still, the fighting was much less than it used to be, and in my view, my mother was very patient. When my father shouted at her, she listened and did not reply. Once, she told him that what he was doing was very difficult, and that every day she prayed he had strength. I was glad for our changed life. In the morning, my father descended the stairs to bathe Birju. At night, my parents no longer shouted so loudly that the nurse's aide had to come and stand at the bottom of the stairs and call out,
"Mrs. Mishra! Mrs. Mishra!"
in a high, put-upon voice. I continued worrying that my father would drink. When he got home and went up the stairs, I watched to see if he put his hand on the railing, because he used to do this for support when he was drunk. At night, if I heard the swollen bathroom door shoved shut, I would wake and lie there, even though I had checked and there was no bottle of scotch under the sink. One evening in the fall, 6 p.m. arrived and my father's silver station wagon did not swing into the driveway. My mother and I went to Birju's room and hefted him into his wheelchair. I rolled him into the kitchen. I stood the wheelchair at the head of the table and began feeding him pureed roti and lentils. 7 passed.
"What's happened to him?"
my mother asked nervously, wiping down the counters with tight looping motions. We rolled Birju back to his bed. The television was on. We laid him down and sat on either side of him and played cards. Birju puffed spit and rolled his blind eyes. My father came home around 9. My mother and I stood by the living room window and watched the car enter our driveway. She, always worried about my father being drunk in public, said,
"Thank God the aide isn't here."
In the kitchen a little later, my mother pleaded with my father.
"This happens. Nobody can be perfect forever. Once or twice, you make mistakes."
My father was standing by the sink, his face dark and flushed.
"Stop bothering me," he murmured.
"Will you eat? Eat something."
"Leave me alone."
For a week, my father kept away from alcohol. He restrained himself without our having to stay awake beside him through the night. He started drinking after this week, and then everything was exactly as it had been. Him lying on the side of his bed, his foot on the floor, my mother standing by him and shouting, me grabbing him and yanking him and demanding he stand. Sometimes I couldn't believe that there had been a time when he had not been drinking. In my memory, the summer that had just passed seemed long gone. In 11th grade, I took the PSAT. I met with my guidance counselor for help on deciding between various colleges. Periodically, Meenakshi and I went to the movies. We would arrive separately, telling our parents that we were meeting friends. Being happy, I looked down on my parents for their unhappiness. I blamed them for it the way the rich cannot help but think that poor people must bring their poverty on themselves. At home, there were endless new humiliations. My father in Birju's room late at night, drunk and sitting at the edge of the small circle of light cast by a table lamp, a Haitian aide looking at him as he talked about how happy he was. My father loved drinking. Later, he would tell me that drinking was freedom, peace of mind, that he felt like he was surrounded by problems, and when he drank, it was as if the alcohol plucked him out from among them. He once said that he would get angry that he didn't weigh more, because if he were heavier, he would be able to drink larger quantities before passing out. Also, He told me that it was around when he started drinking again that he realized that he could not stop drinking, that he had no choice in his drinking, that when he brought the bottle of scotch to his mouth, his hand would keep pressing it to his lips even after he wanted to stop drinking. He said that he would feel as if the hand belonged to someone else. To be hungover all the time was awful. He said that in the morning he would be in his car driving to the train station and, when he heard people on the radio, it was as if they were broadcasting from another country. That he was in a country where there was a war going on, and these people were broadcasting from a nation that was at peace. One night, while drinking in the bathroom, my father suddenly became captivated by the romance of standing outside in the snow in the backyard. He went downstairs, walked outside, and stood under the quiet stars. There was a 2-inch layer of snow, and he was wearing rubber slippers. The snow did not bother him, he later told us. He felt very proud standing there. He thought about how far he had come. In India, he had never seen snow, and neither had his father or grandfather, and now he was living in a country where it snowed every year. After standing in the snow for a little while, my father decided to sit down. He did so. His buttocks felt cold for a moment, and then they were okay.